I'm David Suchet, and this is Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall, and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, welcome back, welcome to a new year.
Yeah, happy new year.
Very exciting. Here we are in the roaring 20s.
Yeah, back in the 20s.
Back in the 20s.
This is our first podcast of 2020. The first podcast you heard in 2020 was our special with David Suchet.
Yes. I hope you liked it.
Hope you enjoyed it. We enjoyed recording it, didn't we?
We did. We had a very, very good time. And we also found a really lovely studio. Nice little studio.
Yeah, we did. That was good.
Very, very enjoyable. Yeah. We hope you enjoy it too.
Yeah, we do.
Nothing?
How are you, Dad?
I'm pretty well, thank you. It's always nice to begin the new year. It always seems to be kind of a bit of a hiatus. We just sort of pause and everything goes on hold for what seems like ages.
But I like the pause.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I'm so restless. I always want something else to do.
I enjoyed the pausing.
No, I'm.
But I'm fine. I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
I'm happy for get going again. Really got some voiceovers to do for the new series of Murder by the Sea, which starts early in January.
It will have started by the time this is on, I think.
Yes, it will. But they've had a whole night.
Tune into CBS Reality to see Dad 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It seems like it. No, that was just the 1st of January. It seemed to go on forever.
They did Murder by the Sea Day.
It was a Murder by the Sea night.
Did they? The whole night.
The whole night. Over and yes, over again. Murder by the Sea everywhere, which was slightly alarming. But it was very... anyway, the new ones start with a particularly vicious crime in Bournemouth, of all unlikely places, committed with a crossbow.
Haven't we done that one?
No, that's a different crossbow.
Oh, a different crossbow killer.
Yeah, that's the Bradford crossbow killing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who knew it was such a popular murder weapon?
Remember, there were three prostitutes killed in Bradford. That
with crossbows?
With a crossbow.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember the
case. Remember the case, yes.
Yeah. Where was the lady who ran out onto the balcony?
That's right, yeah. Exactly.
I do remember that.
But I have had the good fortune to read a really wonderful new thriller called 3 Hours by Rosamund Lupton, which I should be reviewing. And it's about a school being taken over by gunmen in Somerset when it's snowing. It's very, very good. And it's also about psychopathology. And that's significant because this podcast is at least a little bit about what being a psychopath is about. And at one point, she quotes someone talking about psychopaths. They hide among us, ruthless, callous, and superficially charming, master manipulators. Psychopaths are able to display emotions they don't feel. Everyone around them is convinced that those emotions are real, but they lack remorse. That's why it's difficult to spot a psychopath. They can look, actually, like they're more genuine than other people. Because most people don't have to fake emotions all the time, so they don't have any practice at it. But someone who doesn't feel these emotions will have to practice faking them.
Ah,
very, very interesting. And it's also about something we've talked about before. It's also about narcissism. Many psychopaths are desperate narcissists.
Yeah.
As we've established.
Yeah.
And today's case rotates around one of the most remarkable mass killings in recent criminal history. And the characters involved are fascinating.
Yeah, well, we might as well just get on with it then. So this week we are doing Jeremy Bamber in honour of...
The White House Farm Murders. ITV are beginning 6 1-hours, a drama of the events of the White House Farm Murders, which took place in 1985. It's a fascinating case. And as it unfolds, the details become even more interesting. So,
Well, yeah, so you can listen to this and then watch the show and see what you think. Or you could watch the show and then listen to this and see what you think.
Or you could do both.
Yeah, I know, but you might not. Yeah, I suppose actually you would know the story if you were a fan of true crime.
Well, you probably would, but it's quite a long time ago.
I actually don't know it.
It's quite a long time ago. Yeah. 85 is a good old... My father died in 1985.
I was born in 1983.
I know, darling.
I know you know when I was born.
I was there. When you first made an appearance. Yes, it was memorable. But yes, it's a long time ago, and a lot of people don't. I mean, we've talked about this too, haven't we? We sort of said that, you know, everybody immediately thinks, oh, yes, I know all about X. But in fact...
Yeah, well, maybe you just know the name, but you don't actually know the details.
Of what the crime...
When you were talking to me yesterday about Christine Keeler, although I've heard Profumo Scandal and Christine Keeler and all those things many times, I actually don't know the details.
No. It's a very... I like the drama a lot.
All right, anyway, let's go. Here we are with... Well, are we calling it Jeremy Lambert?
I think we called it the White House Farm Murders.
The White House Farm Murders.
Jeremy Bamba was the illegitimate son of a vicar's daughter from Norfolk. She'd had an affair with an army sergeant major, and they decided to put the son, Jeremy, whom she'd actually... her name was Marsham. And she'd called her son Jeremy. But at the age of 6 months, she put him up for adoption through the Church of England Children's Society. And he was adopted by a couple called Bamba. Neville and June Bamba. Neville was a former RAF pilot, a magistrate, wealthy farmer, had a substantial Georgian farmhouse in Essex near Toldant Darcy, 300 acres, which I think belonged to his wife's father originally, June's father, but he became the landowner. He also had a number of other cottages. He owned a caravan park. He was, you know, well off. June, his wife, they married in 1949, was deeply religious. Very, very religious indeed. Neville was a bit of a dictatorial character, 6 foot plus, some say 6 foot one, some say 6 foot four, tall, strong, athletic. They had adopted a daughter before Jeremy Bamba. She was called Sheila. And she was, how can one put it, perhaps a tad wayward. Neville and June ran what I suppose they would call a tight ship. There were farm workers, there was a housekeeper, there was somebody who came in to do the cooking. It was a comfortable life in the Essex countryside. That very distinctive Essex countryside where it's all very, very flat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as if the horizon goes on for miles. It's distinctive. You can see an awful lot of sky. Neville and June weren't able to have their own children.
Hence adopting.
So they adopted Sheila and Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
It would be fair to say that Jeremy had something of a checkered childhood. Expensive schooling, prep school, and then he was sent away to a boarding school, Gresham's in Norfolk. Because, according to Neville, he didn't want his son to go to school with people whom he might later employ on the farm.
Wow.
Jeremy was, there are many allegations. One is that he was abused.
At boarding school?
Or before.
Or by his family?
Not by his family. No, there's never been any suggestion, not even an allegation. But this, again, is very difficult to quantify.
Yeah.
It's always been a rumour, but we don't really know. We do know that he didn't enjoy school and left without any qualifications whatever, much to his father's disappointment. He then, however, went to sixth form college in Colchester in Essex and got 7 GCSEs. So, you know...
Pretty good.
Then his father decided that he would send him to New Zealand to do a scuba diving course. Unlikely, but nevertheless. I always remember I wrote a book once about a man called Sir James Goldsmith, who once rang up the BBC and says, "What is the furthest point on Earth from where I am now?" That was
somebody. Why did he ring the BBC?
Well, good question. And they said, the BBC said, "Oh, it's somewhere in New Zealand." And so he dispatched his son as far away from him as he could possibly get.
Maybe that's what Neville was doing.
Maybe that was what Neville was doing. Anyway, it would be fair to say that Jeremy's slightly wayward youth became a slightly wayward adulthood. When he was in New Zealand, it was alleged that he broke into a jeweller's and stole two expensive watches, that he was involved in, or so the allegation went, that he was involved in heroin smuggling, and he finally had to leave New Zealand because he was involved in the planning of an armed robbery. We are talking about a young man in his early 20s. He returns to this country and doesn't get on terribly well with Neville. Nevertheless, he goes to work as a waiter in the Little Chef on the A12 in Essex. Not at all what his father would have had in mind, I'm sure. But then his father relents and gives him a job, £170 a week, which wasn't an enormous amount, but it wasn't nothing, on the farm. And he gives him a cottage, one of the cottages he owns, not far away from the farmhouse itself, about 3.5 miles, and a car.
That's pretty good.
Well, not bad, considering he's only 23 and hasn't done much of anything except get himself into a bit of trouble here and there.
Yeah.
But it would be fair to say that Jeremy and his parents don't get on very well. There's always seems to be a row about something. Whenever he goes to the house, there's arguments. It would also be fair to say that Jeremy's sister, also adopted, of course, has had almost as wayward a life as Jeremy. Sheila is an art student, and gets pregnant at the age of 17 by a fellow student called Colin Caffell. Neville and June arrange for an abortion for their adopted daughter, but that doesn't put them off the relationship. And in fact, they marry. Sheila and Colin marry and proceed to have twin sons, Nicholas and Daniel. June, Mrs. Bamber, is very, very upset with her daughter, who she thinks is behaving very badly. And then Sheila divorces the husband, Colin. Oh, dear. And she has some psychiatric problems. It would also be fair to say that June, Mrs. Bamber, has had her psychiatric problems herself. She's been treated for depression and at one point was given ECT therapy, electroconvulsive shock therapy. Two occasions, 55 and 58, 1955, 1958. Sheila has problems, and the boys, the twin boys, are put into care on a couple of occasions when she's hospitalised. And they spend a lot of time living with their father, Colin, who has a flat in Kilburn. And Neville Bamber has given his daughter a flat not very far away in Swiss Cottage. It's been arranged that in August 1985, Sheila and her two sons would go to spend a week with the Bambers at the farmhouse, at White House Farm. The boys don't want to go.
The twin boys.
Because they say, "Granny always makes us pray with her every night. And we hate that farmhouse." And they tell her father, their father, that she's got to speak to June Bamber about this. Colin tries. it doesn't seem to have much impact. So now they arrive on the 4th of August. On the night of the 6th of August, there's a family gathering at White House Farm. Jeremy's there, Sheila's there, the boys are there, and Neville and June are there. It's a tense affair. Jeremy doesn't care for his sister. And I suppose you would say you could cut the atmosphere with a knife. Jeremy leaves to go back to his father's cottage, about 3.5 miles away, around 10. The farm secretary rings up Neville not long afterwards, and Neville's in a very bad temper indeed and puts the phone down. Most unlike him. He's really quite an equable man, though a disciplinarian. No one says much about anything. But that night, there is a murder or murders committed which will lodge in the imagination of a generation. So let's take a break. It's the night, the early hours of the 7th of August. At 3:26 a.m., according to Jeremy Bamber, Neville, his father, rings him and says, "Sheila's gone berserk with the rifle." Neville Bamber has a collection of guns, including a semi-automatic rifle with a telescopic sight and a silencer.
Is that a normal kind of gun for a farm person to have?
Yes, rabbits. You know, that kind of thing. It's got a selection, but this is
hunting.
Significantly, Bamber says that he, when he was there that evening before, had left the rifle on the kitchen table along with some ammunition. He thought he heard rabbits, but in the end didn't go out and see any.
Who said that, Neville or Jeremy?
Jeremy, the son. At 3:36... Jeremy rings not 999, but the local police station, Witham, in Essex, and says, "My father's just rung me and said something awful is happening, and Sheila's gone berserk with the gun." The police officers dispatch a patrol car to White House Farm and tell Jeremy to meet them there. Jeremy doesn't exactly rush to the farmhouse, but nevertheless gets there about 10 minutes after the police. Caution is the name of the game, because someone inside might have a rifle. So they don't go into the house. They shout through to Sheila, the daughter. There is one open window on the master bedroom. And so they shout from outside, come out. No response. No response whatever. A series of armed officers arrive, who also decide the best thing to do is to wait until daybreak. In fact, it isn't until about 4 or 5 minutes to 8 in the morning that the police finally break in to White House Farm.
That's odd, isn't it?
It is a little. But we'll come back to it, because all this becomes significant.
Okay.
They break in through the kitchen door. They take a sledgehammer to it. These are in the days before they had those devices, which we see so often now in police raids. And they discover Neville on the floor of the kitchen. He's been shot 8 times. They later establish that he may have been shot, first of all when he was coming down the stairs, and then finally again actually in the kitchen. There's been a struggle. There's a signs of a struggle. The police then search the rest of the house. They find the twin boys, Nicholas and David, shot in their beds, killed. Three shots to the head for one, two to the other. They then find June Bamber killed in the master bedroom. She's wearing her nightdress. She's been sitting up in bed and she's been fired at. The last shot, about a foot from her head, is right between the eyes. They also find Sheila Bamber in the master bedroom, also wearing a nightdress, with the rifle in her hand. She's been shot twice in the throat.
You can't kill yourself with a rifle.
Well, when the police begin the investigation, they are absolutely convinced that this is a murder-suicide. Sheila has a history of psychiatric illness. She is diagnosed schizophrenic. She clearly didn't get on with her mother and father. And they really do not believe.
But you can't hold a rifle with your own hands. It's too long.
Well,
especially if it's got a silencer on it.
Well, this becomes one of the most important issues in the case. Well done, well spotted.
Yeah, well, it's something everyone knows.
And so the investigation could best be described as cursory. They don't secure the crime scene. They leap to the conclusion that it's a murder-suicide. They don't question the fact who made the... Why did Neville phone his son and not the police if he was worried about Sheila? No, nothing. It's significant, or it becomes significant, that Jeremy says at one point to the officers when they're waiting outside White House Farm, well, you know, the caravan park's going to be buying me a Porsche soon. The caravan park, of which he owns 8%.
Oh, I see.
Which is also part of the Bamber estate, so right. to speak. And he's also said, I'm never going to give any of my inheritance to my sister. I can't stand her. Nevertheless, the police come to the conclusion that this is indeed a murder-suicide. Bamber goes on holiday with his then-girlfriend to Amsterdam. She's an art student called Julie Mugford. They have an up-and-down sort of a relationship, but nevertheless, they seem happy enough. The rumour is they buy a very great deal of, a large amount of cannabis on their holiday in Amsterdam. When they return to this country, Mugford admits to the police that she's assisted Jeremy Bamber in a robbery at the caravan park, which they'd staged to make it look as though an outsider had done it. I know it sounds...
Is this before or after the murders?
Before the murders. The police charge Bamber with breaking into the caravan park. He goes on holiday again. This time with a friend. They go to the south of France this time.
Hard life.
While he's away, Julie Mugford changes her story. She's previously told the police... Oh, Jeremy would never hurt his parents. She then tells the police quite the contrary, that he's often threatened to kill them, I can't stand them, and I could do with the money.
Shouldn't have upset Mugford. That was his big mistake.
It was. So now the police have a different theory of what actually happened at White House Farm on that fateful night, the early morning of 7th of August 1985. And an investigation begins. The trouble is that almost all the evidence has not been secured, lost, I mean, it was a catastrophic investigation. I mean, subsequently, even the Essex Police's own internal inquiry comes to the conclusion that it is absolutely...
Just botched the whole thing.
Botched, completely botched. The CPS now have Mugford. They have the discovery of a silencer in the gun cupboard with a fleck of blood on it and some red paint. Now, there has also been a struggle, remember, in the kitchen?
Yeah.
And there is a little mark on the mantelshelf, which is painted red. The police then, of course, point out that Sheila Bamba was a small woman.
Doesn't have arms as long as her body.
And equally could not have struggled with Neville Bamba, who was fit,
potentially
big,
6 foot four.
Yeah, I mean, certainly over 6 foot one. A big, strong, fit man. Then, of course, they point out that, and it becomes obvious, it's a point you've already raised, if the silencer was on the rifle, why would Sheila have then taken it off, put it in the gun cupboard, gone back upstairs and shot herself, which would have been pretty difficult anyway,
yeah,
would have been impossible with a silencer on it.
Yeah.
Why would she have done that? Well, slowly but surely, it becomes apparent that there is another version of the events of that fateful night. This rotates around June Bamba's bicycle. It's perfectly possible that Bamba had gone back to the cottage he had about 3.5 miles away because he'd borrowed his mother's bicycle. Rather than be seen driving back to White House Farm, he could easily, and he'd talked to Mugford about it, have cycled back to White House Farm to have committed the killings and then cycled back again to give himself an alibi. I never left the cottage.
People probably wouldn't have seen him in the dark in the country lane, no lights.
But it's very, very interesting, this, because right now, Bamba has launched yet another appeal about the telephone records that evening.
Right now, as in today?
Right, it launched it in December 2019.
Oh, my God.
The telephone records are very capable of different interpretations. Eventually, the police arrest and charge Bamba with 5 killings. Neville, June, Sheila and the 2 boys. And he stands trial at Chelmsford Crown Court in 1986. On the 28th of October, the jury convict him by a 10-2 majority. The judge doubts whether he should ever be let out, because a man who's capable of killing 2 small boys while they're asleep in bed is clearly heartless.
True.
A psychopath.
True.
Bamba protests his innocence. It wasn't me, it was Sheila. There is no conclusive proof that I killed those 5 people. And he has maintained his innocence from that day to this. He is the only whole lifetime prisoner, because in 1994, 8 years after his first conviction, the then Home Secretary, Michael Howard, gave him a whole life term. If you protest your innocence, it is impossible for you to even be considered for parole. And when I was doing the book called Lifers, which is now called Pure Evil, I got a long letter from Bamba.
Oh, did you?
Indeed.
When it came out? Or while you were writing it?
While I was writing it.
How did he know? Because you did research on
him. I know, I wrote to him.
Oh, and what did he say?
During the past 10 years, I worked... He talks about his case.
The letter's in the book, by the way, everyone, if you want to find it.
It's called Pure Evil now, and it's out in paperback.
You can buy it on Amazon.
Of the 50 or so prisoners who have whole life orders, I'm the only one convicted on a 10-2 majority verdict. I'm one of the few to have been set a tariff of 25 years by the trial judge, only for that to be overturned by an MP, he means by the then Home Secretary, Michael Howard. I've had parole hearings scheduled since 2002. I've fought against the whole life term in the European Chamber of Human Rights. I believe I'm the only one with a whole life order who has constantly maintained his innocence. I was the first UK prisoner to be allowed to take a polygraph test, which he did in 2007, and passed without a shadow of a doubt. I have 33 psychology assessments, all stating that I have no personality disorders or traits of psychotherapy. And he's still arguing that he wants more evidence. When DCI Kennelly completed his report on the case in the 6th of September 1985, he stated that the evidence indicated that Sheila was responsible. A report Essex Police still want to conceal because it proves my innocence. Let's take another break. Jeremy Bamber was 24 when the killings took place at White House Farm. He is still not 60. He has been in jail for 35 years.
Which prison is he in?
He's in Wakefield now.
They move around.
Yeah. He's in the Monster Mansion.
I'm just going to Google him because I don't know what he looks like.
Ah, well, there's many a photo. There's a photo of my own book. Okay. Handsome he was.
Hold on. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's quite handsome.
Yep.
Interesting.
There are lots of pictures of the family on Google.
Yes, I'm just having a look now. Big eyes. Big eyes. Sorry, yeah, carry on.
It's important too, by way of background, to say that June Bamber, Jeremy's mother, adopted mother, didn't have a great deal of time for Sheila. At one point, calling her the devil's child, because she was so wayward. It's one of the most abiding mysteries. Was Jeremy Bamber a charming psychopath? In other words, did he really feel any emotions or not? That quote I read from 3 hours. Was he a master manipulator, or is it, as some people have maintained, one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in 20th century criminal history?
What do you think?
I am almost convinced, but not utterly, that he is a charming psychopath.
10-2.
But he has been remarkably consistent. He has a very considerable website maintaining his innocence, which again I recommend. It's very, very interesting. He has a very distinguished blog, which he puts up. If you look at it now, as I looked at it this week, it's more details of his yet another appeal, more telephone evidence that proves he thinks conclusively that he couldn't have killed the 5 people at White House Farm.
You just can't shoot yourself in the throat with a rifle if you're like my size.
Well, if you kill, also shoot yourself twice.
Yeah, it's not possible. Mm. That's my problem.
Well,
explain that one.
Well, the first shot, the earlier of the two, missed, or it wasn't fatal. The second shot was. I mean, it was lower in the throat.
Oh yeah, no, that part fine, but just like actually, mean, it's the physicality of it so hard.
Well, and the silencer and the fleck of blood.
Yeah, I think if she had been wielding a gun around...
That would have been different.
Neville was there, and he was so big and tall, I'm sure that he would have been able to overpower her and take the
gun. I think that's probably...
would have had to have killed Neville first.
Yes. Yes.
And if he had come down the stairs, it doesn't make sense that she would be in the nightgown upstairs, because it means she would have come downstairs in the nightgown, shot him, made a noise or kerfuffle or whatever for him to come down,
yep.
Fight him, shoot him in the downstairs...
Then go upstairs,
then shoot her kids. By this point, or then shoot her mum, and then shoot her kids, and then go back into the... Because if she shot her kids first, her mum would have got out of bed. So...
Well, let's put it this way. I think the argument that you just put forward is probably what convinced the majority of the jury.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it's not conclusive, but it seems very unlikely that it was Sheila.
Yes, well, what is apparent too is that Jeremy had a bit of a wayward history. For example, in the wake of the killings, he tried to sell some nude photographs of Sheila to the Sun for £25,000.
That's gross.
It's everyone involved in the case is to some extent tarred. I mean, Mugford, Julie, sold her story to the Sun, so the News of the World after the conviction. It's a very bleak case, but an absolutely riveting one.
Yeah, fascinating.
Because did Jeremy Bamber, as he'd boasted on a number of occasions, he knew how to get into the house through a window in the kitchen, which had a faulty latch, so he could have climbed in through the kitchen window and then gone out and snapped it back. So with the
yeah. And if so, if they didn't do a proper search, they wouldn't have looked for any of those things.
No. And interestingly...
So I bet there was, like, footprints under the window and yeah, all the stuff we would look for now.
Absolutely. And as Bamber himself has pointed out, and with some strength, the silencer wasn't found for 3 days, and guess who found it? The cousins who in the end inherited the Bamber money, which he's always insisted was the reason that it was found. I do believe in British justice. I do believe that it's very rare for juries to get things wrong, although I have, as you know, campaigned on a number of occasions when I believe that juries have got it wrong, but they usually get it right. This is a very interesting and significant case, and fully worthy of a 6-part television drama. Anyway, that is The White House Farm Murders.
Thanks so much, Dad. The White House Farm Murders.
So what's the week? We're sort of back to sort of ordinary again.
Back to reality.
I think I've been in reality all the way through. It's nice to get back to a case like this.
Yeah, back to the podcast.
Well, very good. I really enjoyed the live one.
Oh, yeah, it was so fun.
Yeah.
For those of you who couldn't make it, you will have heard the live podcast went out over Christmas. We had a really jolly time, didn't we, doing
very,
that?
Very jolly.
Thanks to everyone who came and showed their support. And thank you to all of you listeners. I've been getting lots of nice emails. Dad, I need to show you. You've got a few more. And we've got, the Instagram followers are ever slowly increasing. And I really appreciate all of your comments and likes on our pictures and support. It's really...
It's incredibly important.
We're so grateful.
I'm very, very grateful.
So grateful. And we read all of your emails.
We do.
And we're going to make a concerted effort this season to go through them all and pick people that you guys have asked us to do.
Yes.
So we're going to try and do at least one of those a month or maybe more if we can. We'll be doing that. And you never know, 2020, we might branch out of the UK and the US to other territories.
Yes, I'm certainly going to do the Canadian.
Oh, yes, well, we'll do that. And And yeah, so on that and
Instagram, Twitter, we're incredibly grateful. Do send us a message.
Yeah, and please like and subscribe our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wherever you get them.
And obviously on Audio Boom because they support us and look after us. And
very much
really
so.
Really nice. And thank you to our producer, Poppy Damon. Oh, and I know something I should have said ages ago. My brother Dan came and did all the music live for the podcast and I just didn't thank him at any point during the entire thing. And it was a disgrace. Well, he played all that music live. It sounded amazing.
Well, it did. And let's thank him again now.
Yeah, so I would like to give a big thank you above all to my brother Dan Wansel who played the music live for us at our live podcast, and he has written and performed the music which is on our podcast every week.
That's right, and we have so many people to thank, but certainly Poppy,
our producer Barney's Beagle, who did our sound for us on the podcast, live podcast, and has helped us sort our sound issues out.
Yep.
On this one, very
and
grateful.
We're very grateful to everyone, but most of all we're grateful to the listeners, to you the listeners.
Yes, we are.
As I often say, and I mean it, bad things can happen to good people. And so do be careful out there.